Hey, Coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Hey, Coach. I'm excited to announce a brand new way to access our resources to elevate your coaching monthly memberships. At Basketball Immersion, we know every coach's journey is unique, just like your player's skill sets. That's why we're dedicated to providing you with the flexibility you crave. Our new monthly access plan lets you get full access to all our videos and courses on a month-to-month basis, giving you the freedom to cancel or renew as needed. Whether you're just starting out or looking to add some fresh perspectives to your existing coaching repertoire, Basketball Immersion has the resources to help you reach your goals. Head over to basketballimmersion.com to take control of your coaching journey and unlock your full potential with Basketball Immersion.
Hey, Coach, welcome to the Basketball Podcast. Today, I'm your guest, Chris Oliver. And I wanted to share a little bit of my journey over the last year, particularly around moving to Los Angeles, having a great experience in the Los Angeles area, love it, and some of the challenges that have come up. And I think this is a part of the process and part of the journey for me that has been fascinating and frustrating. And I believe there's value in sharing it with you. In addition to that, I'm going to share some practice audio with you, which I'm not sure if that's been done on a podcast before, certainly not on this one, and then talk you through what I'm trying to do and how I'm doing it. I think the one real challenge for coaches when I talk to them at clinics or members of our community, who generally, if they dive in, will get it all figured out and have great success and great experience, and particularly the players will have great satisfaction around applying some of these experiential and evidence-based ideas that I share. But a lot of the challenges for coaches who maybe are a little unsure about what I'm talking about when I'm talking about coaching the game while they're playing the game is, what does it actually look like? I had a Division I assistant coach who was in between jobs attend the session that I'm going to talk about. And it was amazing to be able to, one, have him there, and then two, be able to have interactions with him during and after, and to really get his feedback and his views on what we were doing and how we're doing it and get his perspectives on it. The session in question, I was coaching 10 to 12-year-olds, essentially all in that age group. It was the first of six sessions of player development. And now when I say player development, I'm doing it as player development and team development all at the same time, because I don't think they're disconnected. They're interconnected. And the whole two-hour session, essentially, we played 5-on-5. We played something called 5-on-5 outlet to coach. Now, there are variations of that within that, obviously, with constraints and different types of dynamic starts and different types of 5-on-5 versions, especially near the end. But the basic concept for this group, who were all new learners to what I was going to teach them, that we started from 5-on-5 and we stayed in 5-on-5 the whole time. And the perspective from the Division I coach who was there was a great question that probably answered everything that I needed to hear. And he said, why don't we all do this? And the answer is pretty simple. We don't all do this because we don't quite understand necessarily what I'm talking about, because it's really hard, especially on a podcast. It's really hard when you see my Twitter feed. It's really hard when you see some of the YouTube videos I post to necessarily fully grasp it. So I want to present this to you. I would love to hear all of your interactions after the fact, whether it's on Twitter, Instagram, social media, wherever it is, or email, and reach out to me and please ask any questions. And then I'm going to do a few other podcasts like this to be able to really hit home some of these ideas. So my journey was moving to Los Angeles for my daughters primarily, and only because we wanted them to have a bigger experience. We're living in Palm Desert, Palm Springs area, which is wonderful as well. I loved living there. But for my daughters, we felt like they needed a bigger experience. So we got involved. They go to Sierra Canyon. Grateful for that experience. Incredible people, incredible school. Just an amazing experience for them all the way around with that. And then we got involved with a AAU program, which has been, again, amazing and just enlightening for me. Certainly, I've heard a lot about AAU through my years, and I've been involved with AAU in different levels. But to be immersed in it as a parent, and now as a coach, it's been even more fascinating. I'll share more ideas on that. This is necessarily about AAU or youth basketball development, as much as it is just sharing this journey that I've been on to be able to finally get to the point where I was able to start to run these development sessions. And primarily, most of the players that come are from the AU program that we're a part of. And I'm grateful for that, that certainly their parents in particular saw the need for something a little bit different. And in no way do I sit here in judgment. I'm not that person. And hopefully, if you follow me online, that I'm not here to tell someone they're wrong. I'm not here to tell someone that what they're doing is just idiotic. That's not how I'm approaching it. And I feel for some of you because I don't really know, and that's probably a deeper conversation. I don't really know why others are doing it that way. We don't need to be critical of others, but we do need to be educational and we do need to be open-minded and we do need to suspend judgment and to get beyond some of these historical and cultural norms in coaching. The reality is, 15 years ago, just think about how much humanity has evolved in 15 years, whether it's with technology or understanding of different things, whether it's medical, et cetera, AI. Think about that. And then a lot of us are still coaching the way we did 15 years ago with this stubbornness to say, that's the way we've always done it. It worked for me. And I've seen this. I've seen this certainly with my daughters being coached at different phases of their youth basketball phase, where a coach essentially coaches the way that they were coached. And they're now 40 years old. And that's clearly a very different world. And the way that our players, our young people in particular, consume information is completely differently than the way they did 40 years or 20 years ago when they played. So all those things are factors in this. So I just really want you to approach this from open-mindedness and suspend judgment the same way that I would when I see somebody do something online that I don't necessarily align with. But I've coached long enough. I've coached for 30 years, and I certainly appreciate other perspectives and other needs for different things. So my hope here is to challenge you to consider making over, consider subtracting, or consider adding some of the things I say to what you do. Now, to start, I'm going to play the clip. So bear with me. It's about a 4-minute clip of audio only. If you'd like to get the video, you can go to basketballimmersion.com/5on5podcast and you'll be able to watch the video for free. basketballimmersion.com/5on5podcast and you'll see the video with the audio. But the key part here is the audio highlights a lot of the things I'm going to talk about. So take a moment, listen to the audio, and then I'm going to come back and talk about all the things that went into this session so that you can get a good understanding of how I started with a 10 to 12 year old group with 5-on-5 conceptual offense with a structured unstructured approach and conceptual defense in trying to shape their learning with what I now call a whole approach, part only if I need it. And I'll talk more about that after you listen. Enjoy the audio.
You understand? Don't skip to two if there's no advantage to skip to two, right? Figure it out.
Okay, hold. Let's go down here. Gray, sit up in 5 spots. Blacks, get up there. Let's go. You're on defense. Go. It's okay. You will make mistakes. This will be messy, but this will help you understand all the things we're trying to develop right now. This is called neutral. Why is this neutral? Because the defense is set, organized, and it's what-to-what with the ball. He's what-to-what with the ball. Chest to chest. Chest to chest is neutral. So there's no advantage. So we want to create an advantage. The first thing we're going to do to create an advantage is called dribble at. You are going to dribble at A5. And if I dribble at you, you're going to cut. Now, cut to the middle of the rim. Why do we want to cut to the rim? We want to cut to what? Anybody remember? Cut to score. You might be open and I pass it to you and you get to score. Go with them. Come with me, Bruce. You're covering me. He cuts to the rim. Anytime we dribble at, that triggers, trigger is a key word, that triggers the weak side corner to flash. Now, why do you not want to come to? Because then you take away her what? Great job adjusting. You knew that right away, even though your instinct was to come. Now, you want to come to a space, not a spot. Come to space, not a spot. Now, if I pass it to her, I have a whole bunch of possibilities. I can cut back to the ball. We call it a get. Go back and get the ball. If Bruce denies me back to the ball, I can cut back door. Okay? I can cut, not get the ball, and I can go screen, or I can cut. There's a whole bunch of possibilities. Meanwhile, what has that created? Space. There's a gap somewhere. Now, you don't know where to go, but you can go there, or you can hold your spot. So the other spacing spot right now is what we would call the dunker spot, which is when you cut to the rim and you don't know where to go to the dunker spot. So that's a spot just off of the baseline, slightly off the baseline, but below the backboard. So you create more what? From there, you don't know what's going to happen, but we must run the dribble out. Go back. Good luck. Dribble out. Good. Cut. Press. Hold. Recreate. Hold your corner. Tomorrow, you're doing the right thing. Hold the corner. Because what are you creating? We dribble at someone. Who does it trigger to come up? The weak side what? Weak side corner. So you're the flash now, press. You're the get. Come. Come and try and get the ball. Now, we don't want to try and get it outside three. If we can, we want to try and get it inside three. Pass. And now we want to play off of that. You can come. You can cut. You can't dance. That's the only thing you can't do. Okay, let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Cut. Tomorrow, you stay in the corner. Turnover. Go the other way. Let's go. Go. Figure it out. You got to dribble at someone. Okay, turnover. Got to run dribble at. Go black. Got to run dribble at. Get organized. Go the other way. Go the other way. Go the other way. Good. Dribble at someone. Good. Okay. If the ball comes at you, cut. Good. Cut. And then who's the trigger? Not there. Yeah, that's fine. But you're coming up into there. And then play from there. Start it again. So must run what? Cool. So get organized and run a dribble at.
I'm hoping you enjoyed the audio. Again, a little bit different, but it just helps shape the rest of the conversation. In the sense now that I can talk a little bit about what you hear. And if you go to basketballimmersion.com/5on5podcast, you can watch the video. But what I want to start with is that my number one goal in starting with 5on5 is that I want to teach the game as a whole. I don't want to disconnect the game yet. Later in the learning process, later in the development process, I will certainly break down a lot of the concepts that they heard. Now, I'll primarily only break them down in terms of offense versus defense. And throughout all six sessions, I won't do anything that is on air outside of what I call homework is something at the end of the session where I get the parents on the floor or engage the parents along with the players. And I give them some things, let's say three times between your legs, shoot the ball, in and out cross, shoot the ball. And then maybe the roll-ups and then some type of mixing interleaving of those things. And I show them to the player and the parents, and I talk to them about the fact that this is something they can do in player-led development. So that's something they can go home with. They can work on it on their own. That's player-led development. So I do some on air to be able to shape some of those things that they can work on their own. But when I'm there as a coach, I feel my value is far more important than just doing on-air repetitions. My value is that I can better connect skills and decisions for the players. I want to also say the parents are very much active participants in this process. I spend a lot of time engaging with the parents before and after, explaining what they're going to see, explaining why they're seeing it, and then educating them about what we're doing and why we're doing it. I feel that in my youth development or my youth basketball experience in terms of development, particularly so far, the biggest ally for improving youth basketball development is the parent. I've been around very few parents that haven't been very supportive and very interested in just constantly seeking better ways for their son or daughter or daughters or sons to improve. And it's been really refreshing. I've had so many great conversations with parents, and I certainly haven't seen many examples of bad parents. I see parents that care about their kids. I see parents that are invested in their son or daughter's development, and I see parents that are curious, because a lot of these parents are in fields or professions where those professions have evolved quite a bit. If you think about the medical profession, just say 15 years ago to now, and how much technology and our understanding and new evidence-based researched ideas and different things like that. And I've had conversations with doctors about that. And it's just so fascinating because they tell me the different things that they're doing now that they didn't do even last year, and that they're constantly seeking better ways. And of course, we all want that from our doctor, wouldn't we? We want them to be on the cutting edge. We want them to be using the most modern, most effective approach. We want them to use the most evidence-based approach. And yet, as coaches, we often don't see things that way. Now, some of us are limited with time. Some of us are limited with resources. Some of us are limited with energy. So again, there's no judgment. Anyone that's supporting any basketball experience for young people, I'm all for it. And you're just doing incredible work. And I thank you for all that work. But the fact remains that there are better ways to be able to do things based on the experiential knowledge that I brought to you for 30 years of trying these things and doing these things and failing at some things and throwing them out and doing other things that I keep and say, this really works. It's really effective. This connects for players and this helps players individually improve and helps their team win. That's beautiful. That's what I want, to constantly find those things. And things that aren't helping players individually improve and aren't leading towards team improvement or team success, then I don't want to do those things anymore. So just like that conversation with the doctor, myself as a coach, constantly seeking new ways. And the way that I'm coaching now, even with this group in these sessions, is different than the way I coach my college team. It's very different. I approach it a lot differently, particularly around the areas of psychological safety, around making sure that every player feels they belong. I think when I was a college coach, I slanted too much towards being overly competitive, overly intense, and I'm still those things. But I balance it a lot better with a whole bunch of things. So teaching the game for me is not disconnected. We taught out of 5-on-5. And we particularly, just to give you an idea, the drill, as I said, 5-on-5, outlet to coach. The outlet to coach is so that we remove transition. It was alternate possession each time. And then we would use different constraints, things that shape learning, to be able to help the players understand and develop the ideas. The overall concept, let's start with the spacing template. The spacing template was 5 out. So players would go to 5 spacing spots, usually on the perimeter, but they certainly had the possibility to be able to go to the dunker spots or the high posts. But the 5 spacing spots in the 5 out were obviously the corner, the 45, and the top. Very traditional. A lot of us are using it nowadays. The problem with 5 out spacing is clearly that there are single gaps all over the floor. So if one of our main principles of play is spacing, then we need to teach players how to create double gaps to be able to create advantages and hopefully big advantages to be able to attack and play basketball. So we gave them a structure, which was the spacing template. The spacing template was 5 out. Now that 5 out, as I said, could evolve into dunker spot, high post. So it's a 4 out, 1 in, which creates a double gap. But intuitively, players didn't do that on their own. So we knew we had to create some type of structure for them to be able to create 5 out. Now, we didn't start that way. We initially, and I do this for all new teaching with all new drills or all new concepts, is that the first thing I do is I teach the drill before I teach the tactics and the technique. So my initial communication to those players was, okay, let's have a gray team, let's have a black team, and then let's have a multicolor team down the far end, and the whites is going to go against the black team. And then we're in transition with the black against the multicolor team. Okay, you're 5 out, that's your spacing, start out of 5 out, outlet to coach, and now let's go. And that was as simple as it was. There was no communication about tactics, principles of play, technique in that first communication. All it was getting them an understanding of the drill. I wanted them to be able to devote cognitive effort to learning the things, whether it's tactics or techniques, that I wanted to shape, rather than worry about the drill at the same time. So all their cognitive effort at first was just focused on learning 5-on-5 and outlet to coach. And it may seem simple, but at 10 to 12, there were certainly some players that struggled with understanding that they had to outlet the ball, that when they converted from defense to offense, they needed to get the ball and get it outletted to the coach, and nobody else is going to do them for them. And little things like that, and little nuances. And it didn't take them long, but there's certainly some hiccups early on, which is beautiful because learning is messy. Learning is messy, and we embrace that. And certainly early on, the whole 5-on-5 play that we saw in those kind of, let's say we went 10 trips back and forth of different teams playing 5-on-5, they were all ugly. Most of them were single gap attacks, and most of them were breaks downs defensively where the defense was either wrong or lazy, and advantage was created more out of that than any type of application of a principle of play or a tactic. So that was the initial part. After they understood the 5-on-5 small-sided game or challenge or drill or 5-on-5, whatever you want to call it. After they understood that, then hold, and we brought them in and we taught the principles of play that we wanted to have appear. Now I said hold, and I want to make sure that you understand that. Classroom management is a huge part of my coaching and my environment. I was a teacher by background. My first few years in a classroom, I reflect back on what they taught me in my teaching degree, my teacher's education degree, and my master's degree in education. And I reflect back on that and I realize how little practical information they actually gave me about teaching in a classroom. And that has shaped a lot of my philosophy and probably my obsession here with making sure that I give you extremely practical information. So the practical classroom information that I didn't know was, how do I make sure that the students in the classroom are on task, meaning there's behaviors that are not taking them off task, whether it's acting out, talking when other people are talking, not actually opening their books or doing their work, whatever it is, all those different things that you can think about as time wasters in the classroom. Or from my perspective, that my teaching time, my talking time, my management time of students was so long that they didn't get enough time to be able to interact with the material. Applying that to a coaching setting, somebody told me this a long time ago, a coaching crime is wasting time. A coaching crime is wasting time. These management strategies help me avoid wasting time. The other thing they help me do is they help me maximize time on task and active learning time. Okay, you can certainly go read, we've got tons of blogs on that on Basketball Immersion. But what that basically means is players learn by doing. They learn by physically practicing, connecting perception and decision and skill execution and feedback on what happened, feedback on results. That process is what leads to learning through retrieval, practice, and retention. So that is the most important part of the process. Throughout a two-hour practice, I want to maximize the number of repetitions my players get with physical practice, or especially with new learning, perceptual repetitions where it may be slower learning, but it connects skills and decisions because they are still seeing things in the context of that. You can think about slow learning as walkthrough reps. So what were these classroom management strategies? If you've seen me teach ever, and if you've been on Basketball Immersion, then you know, hold means hold the ball, no extra shots, no extra dribble. So it was actually 17 players in the gym. So two teams had subs and they subbed on their own. I empower players to figure it out on their own. I'm not there to manage those different things. I want to put them in leadership situations where they have to figure it out on their own. So they're responsible for subs. But for me, if they're playing 5-on-5 and I want to teach something, or if I want to make a point, then all I need to do is communicate hold. Hold means hold the ball, no extra dribbles, no extra shots. I've run camps where I have 80 kids in the gym, everyone with a ball doing something, and I'll just shout hold, and then everyone holds the ball. What's the advantage of that? It means that they know what the command means. They know to hold the ball, and I connected for them in saying that you are holding the ball so that I can teach quickly so you can get back into doing what you want to do, which I asked them, what do you want to be doing? And they say, play basketball. So I connect all of our management strategies to the fact that they get to play more basketball. And I think that's a really important point. Like every strategy that I do in practice is trying to connect back to the player individually getting better, the team getting better, and obviously them maximizing the number of basketball repetitions they get in a practice. Hold means hold the ball. When I count down and you'll hear it, 4, 3, 2, 1. Again, I have no idea what's ever going to happen as a consequence when I get to 0. But generally, whenever I count down, players move faster somewhere. So it's really just a hustle prompt. But I use that to be able to encourage players to be able to get somewhere faster. So let's say I hold everyone outside the 3-point line. 4, 3, 2, 1. They're sprinting. They're getting there. Or they're jogging. They're getting there. Again, I usually don't get hung up on how fast or how slow. But let's say there is a player that isn't getting in very fast. One time does not make it a problem. One time does not make it a problem. But multiple times makes it a problem. And the first thing I would do in terms of engaging with them would be a mini conversation. Hey, I really want you to improve at basketball. If you're not getting in quickly, then you're not going to get as good as you can get at basketball. And if the behavior obviously proceeds, then clearly we've got to have a communication about the impact on the greater environment that we're trying to create. And environment's so important because clearly my thing in basketball practice is to create an environment for learning, a learning environment, an environment where they can reach beyond their current level by feeling safe and by feeling challenged. And I would say, having observed, let's say I saw 50 different practices, usually kind of college practices this year, but I saw a few high school practices. I would say one of the biggest things that you could add to your practices is just increasing the challenge. I find a lot of practices, players know what they're going to do in advance, whether it's just a memorized drill or it's the same drill they've done before, or it's a drill with no kind of additional things. Let's say we're doing the same one-on-one drill every day. There's different ways to load challenge into that drill by changing the constraints, or let's say we just add a plus one at the rim. So now it's one-on-one plus one at the rim. Anytime you add extra players, you load challenge in. But I would say that's one of the things that stood out from watching so many practices this year. I think there's a lot more coaches running game-based practices. And I think one of the challenges then is to be able to increase the challenge so that we have this optimal challenge point and engagement for players. Usually players aren't engaged in a practice, not because they're not focused, but because the drill or the activity we're doing in practice is not engaging. And again, it's one of those things before you look at them, look in the mirror, and usually it has something to do with practice design more than it has to do with the individual person in terms of that. So hold the ball, 4, 3, 2, 1, this countdown. And then we usually use recreate. Recreate means go back to the spot where we want to teach from. So say they're in a 5-on-5 situation, a player passed to the wing and then followed their pass right towards the ball with creating no advantage. So there wasn't a cut through, an inside cut. It wasn't a ball screen. It was just literally a cut that took away space. Hold the ball, recreate. And I would say, go back to the spot before you pass the ball. And then we can talk in the context in which the intervention is trying to get its point across, which we're trying to intervene in this situation and trying to get them to understand a principle of play relative to space and then be able to have them do it. The part that connects with that you'll hear, certainly on the audio, and then obviously you'll see me talk about a lot, is follow feedback with action. So many of us as coaches give incredible feedback, like really knowledgeable stuff, really brief, specific information to players, but then we move on and they never get a chance to apply it. And to me, again, application as a physical, in the physical way, applying the drill or the skill or the technique to a basketball situation is what helps them connect it from practice to games. And that's ultimately our goal with everything we do in practice. I don't think there's any argument there. We're trying to practice so that it helps a player play better in the game. So we want transfer from practice to the game. And you think about that, if you heard the term representative practice, so much of the communication about representative practice is just saying, well, why are you doing something in a practice that doesn't happen in a game and doesn't happen in the way you're doing it in a game? Sometimes we're doing it that way because we want to task simplify something. So we might go from, say, we're running a 2-on-2 get drill. They're struggling with the 2-on-2 get timing. So maybe we decouple it or we unload the drill and we go to 2-on-1 or we go to 2-on-0. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I just wouldn't start there. I would always start with the hard first, meaning I want to start with the most complex thing. And that's why we start this whole session out of 5-on-5, because I want to play 2 hours at 5-on-5, because I feel if I do decouple or unload things the next week, they will understand that we're connecting it back to the game situation and what we're doing within that 2-on-2 gets, pass and go back and get it and play out of that live. That's trying to help them be better out of what we call dribble outs, which I'll talk about in a second. That's the whole point of representative practice, is we're representing the game so that they can be more effective in that. So hold the ball, recreate. And usually I use the word foul. Sometimes I just go to turnover, but foul means there's a mistake. And turnover usually is the consequence of the foul, meaning that somebody didn't apply the constraint. So I'll give you a quick example. Look, a natural and logical consequence in a basketball practice is that if you make a mistake, you lose possession of the ball. It's the simplest one. If you think about an offensive mistake, if you make an offensive mistake, then you lose possession of the ball. That's not an all the time thing, but if we put in a real simple constraint, meaning we must run a dribble out action before it's live, and that's how we shape play out of 5-on-5, is we must do something before something else can happen. And if they don't run the dribble out after that initial learning, then we just say foul and it's a turnover and that team loses possession of the ball. So the consequence of not doing the thing that we want you to do to help shape your learning for the game is that in that example, you don't get to play offense. We could also have a natural logical consequence of, say, your team goes off. So you're no longer playing basketball. Now, we do a lot of different things where they're very quick transitions, and there's no point where we'll play, say, 5-on-5 for 10 minutes and five players are off the floor. And I see that all the time. We either go 5-on, which means a team is always waiting and a team's basically one possession removed from playing basketball, or we'll play some type of trips where we'll start at one end and say the two teams will play multiple trips. So they go one trip at that rim and then they'll go down and back. And we call that 3 trips. So they'll play multiple trips, but only 3 possessions. And then the other team will sub in. So we want to maximize their time on the floor, not off the floor. And we want to maximize their time and their ability to be able to connect the things that we're talking about. So all those things came into play in this situation. So we said already, we let them play the game and figure it out. So the first time we taught the 5-on-5, just the structure, get to the spacing spots, and now play whatever happens. I'm not stopping. I'm not coaching. They figure out the drill. And then I brought them in, and I actually started with teaching conceptual defense. Why did I start with defense? To improve your offense, we need to improve our defense. And I felt that just by teaching a few simple things, and basketball is a game of opposites, so there's a benefit to this beyond that, which means that we're connecting offense at the same time we're connecting defense. And that's why I always like to teach with offense and defense on the floor. We tend to do this defensively where we almost never teach a defensive situation without the offense being on the floor. But for some reason, when I watch practices, I see almost all offensive situations being first taught on air without the defense. But when you teach the defense, you usually have your offense on the floor and you're walking through the situation at first. There's very little on-air defense. So I don't know why it's okay to just go constantly on-air offense. And again, I'm not anti on-air offense. 5-on-0 is okay with me. 5-on-0 leads to the structure. So if players are struggling with the structure, you can give them 5-on-0 to be able to help memorize and learn the structure. But once they know the structure, we want everything to go unstructured. So the only way I would use 5-on-0 is this. We play 5-on-5. They're struggling with it. Okay, get to a rim, 5-on-0, probably like a minute or 2 minutes. And then we would come back to the 5-on-5. Because ultimately, no matter how good we get in 5-on-0, the challenge is obviously playing against an opponent and playing with your teammates versus an opponent that is actively trying to stop you from doing what you're doing. The 5-on-0 can provide them some freedom in memorizing and understanding the pattern or the structure, but it's certainly not the solution. Solutions are based on their decisions, per se, perceive, decide, execute, relative to a defender and relative to their teammates. So we want to connect it to the game. In this example, we taught what we call dribble at. So we had 5 players on offense, 5 players on defense, and the other group was at half court watching. We walked through what dribble at, which is a really simple concept. When the ball's in the middle of the floor, for example, dribble at the 45, that 45 cuts to the basket, and that triggers the weak side corner to flash into space, not a spot. We cut to space, not to spots, because we can't tell them exactly where the space is going to be. And that connects to principles of play. Again, I'll talk about those in a second. But that concept, so dribble at is very simple at a 5-out. And we have an in-depth breakdown of dribble at and all the different nuances that in basketball immersion membership community. I used it extensively as a lag-free transition from the 2-side into conceptual offense. And we run the dribble at simply because we often ran 2-side into 5-out spacing, which didn't create single gaps. So dribble at immediately allows us to be able to create double gaps because we cut a player to the basket and then we can create space from there, but we can also have someone flash into what we called them quicks, but they're now called gets, obviously extensively throughout basketball, and we would run gets out of that action. Now, at no point do we have to run any of that. And that was one of the beautiful things about working with this really young group and starting with them with these concepts very early, is that we frame it for them as saying, hey, listen, we're giving you a structure from which you can understand spacing. The structure is not the decision. Basketball decisions supersede basketball plays. So yeah, we gave them a structure. You can call it a play if you want, dribble at, although it's a little bit more conceptual and free than a specific spot-to-spot play. And I love plays, by the way. I'm not anti-plays. But any play we run, even if it was highly structured, we want to run a very specific play to get a very specific person a shot, with almost no exception, if a player has an advantage, and they are a player that is capable of taking advantage of that advantage, then we want them to break the play because the basketball decision supersedes the basketball play. So in this example, we gave them this dribble out structure. Now they must run that. So then we would go back to this 5-on-5 and play 5-on-5 on a dribble out. I skipped ahead a little bit. Defense. So basketball is a game of opposites. So I talk defense first. We call defense and really help defense from a conceptual standpoint. We call it shrink the floor. Why do we call it shrink the floor? We have three principles of play that are the framework for all conceptual decisions for our offense and for our defense, for our individual players and our team. The framework is this, our principles of play. Number one is space. Number two is advantage. And number three is how we define shot selection, which is bronze medal is a contested shot. Silver medal is an open shot, depending on the age, but at the higher level, it's an open three. And then a gold medal is any type of shot in the smile. Now, if you don't have a smile on your floor, the rest of the world has smiles on their floor. I know in America, many of your states don't have the charge circle yet, but we call that the smile. It's a beautiful thing. And it's one of the best things to be able to help your players conceptually on offense and defense. We call it the happiest place on earth because the offense always wants to get to the smile because that creates a big advantage. You either score or you draw two. You score or you draw two. That's the goal of every offensive player. We want offensive players to drive to score, catch to score, and cut to score. And in all those situations, you can draw two. You can draw two on a catch because the defense screws up a rotation and two people rotate to you. You can cut to the basket and have your defender and draw help. You can drive to the basket and create a shoulder-to-chest advantage on your defender and draw help. It's our constant framework of decision-making off the dribble for players is to be able to understand, did you draw one? Then you should be a scorer. If you draw two, then you are a passer, and to be able to make those decisions. I coached last year at my daughter's school. I coached outside of my daughter's that had a little bit of conceptual understanding of basketball. Basically, I would say the other six players on the team, by and large, hadn't played basketball with any type of kind of coaching or structure before. So we created this really simple mantra for them to constantly understand this framework. And all we would say to them is shoot when you're open, which is defined by in range and capable of making the shot for them. Pass when someone else is open and drive when no one else is open. So that connected with obviously at the level I'm at now where we talk about cut to score, drive to score, catch to score. Again, I'm jumping around a little bit, but you can get the picture of it, especially if you really listen to that audio and you go watch the video. But the idea of this is that we can always provide them with a solution based on what they perceive and decide and execute. Now, the other part of all that decision-making, shoot when you're open, pass when someone else is open, and drive when no one else is open, is it's basically a progression of reads. If my 12-year-old daughter catches it outside the three-point line and she has more than arm length advantage, then we would define that as space and she should shoot. If she doesn't have arm length advantage because the defense is closing out or she didn't feel comfortable with whatever factor it was and someone else is open, then she should pass. And obviously what can apply to all that is if she catches the ball and she perceives that she has space, then we want to drive that space. That's drive when no one else is open. And that usually happens when, again, if the defense, the simplest example to understand that is if the defense is in denial, then the ball has space to be able to drive because there's probably not help one pass away. So that mentality with that. So those things were a big part of the conversation. So the first principle of play is space. We want players to understand space. Do you have space? How can you create space? How can we figure out how to create the double gap, as I said? And what type of situation can we put ourselves in where we have a spacing advantage? That's one of the biggest advantages of the two-side break. If you're not familiar with it, I cannot encourage you enough. I mean, we've even created it so the two-side break is a standalone course at basketballimmersion.com/sales. You can buy the two-side break alone, but just a great spacing template for developing conceptual understanding of transition. But one of the biggest parts of the two-side break is to be able to pass the ball early and opposite. Instead of trying to pass up the ball side wing a lot, which we're not saying don't, but generally it's not the biggest advantage, we're trying to pass across the court or dribble across the court. And in those situations, it's literally, let's say one of your handlers got the ball in space, in transition. If somebody is open opposite side of the floor, across from them, then we want to pass immediately early and opposite because that moves the defense. And that's our goal, to try and get it into space to create big advantages. If the defense doesn't allow us to have any space, meaning they got out to that early and opposite and they took away the ball side wing, then that creates space for the point guard or the handler to be able to point guard push. And that relates to that mantra that we said is drive when no one is open. So if they can pass when someone else is open and drive when nobody else is open, a very simple template for understanding decision-making and transition. And that really connects to the two side, which is essentially a spacing template that goes with it. Once the two sides exhausted, then we're going to go into this dribble at concept to be able to try and create these advantages of space. So that's a principle play. The second principle play is advantage. We want to create big advantages, and we can create big advantages in multiple ways. Let's think about it really simply in terms of, let's say, we see it a lot in the NBA playoffs. They're hunting a matchup as a version of trying to create an advantage. We know we have an advantage. Either we have a mouse, which means we have a size advantage, or we have a turtle, which is some type of speed attack advantage. We call them mouse and turtle. A turtle is someone we can attack in space, and a mouse is someone we can attack at the rim. And we just communicate those things. And again, for these 10 to 12 year olds, we immediately communicate that. Now, they don't go hunt matchups and they don't look for matchups and they don't quite think about it that way yet. But we do want them to start thinking about their advantage relative to someone else or their disadvantage relative to someone else. Because again, mostly disadvantages are realities. They're not weaknesses. Now, certainly there's weaknesses if a player can't dribble the ball. But what we're talking about more in this case is if you're small, then you need to learn to play with your reality, which is if you get post up, what are you going to do to solve that problem? So we talk about realities. And that's what some of these things in terms of advantage as a principle of play helps us do. Disadvantage, advantage. That's why we play a lot of small-sided games, starting with those points so that we can learn how to play out advantage and take away advantage, or play out a disadvantage and learn how to create an advantage. And basketball is a game of opposite, so those things apply to both. Shot selection, pretty straightforward. So think about it now, me teaching defense to these young players. They understand that, okay, offense is trying to create space, so it's a game of opposites, so defense is trying to take away space. We think about advantage, offense is trying to create an advantage. How can we take away that advantage? Let's say it's a player that has a turtle on them. So a player is on the top, they have a turtle on them, meaning they can definitely beat them off the dribble. Then how do we take away that advantage? We take that advantage away by taking away the space for that matchup, and that would be shrink the floor, where our players are now, instead of being maybe in denial or maybe being in traditional help positioning, we would actually shrink more. And in a, not to give away my AAU secrets, we actually have something where we've defined it as paint, where we literally play against some players that just draw our drivers and don't shoot. And all we say to all our players, we're in player-to-player defense, we're not in a zone, but we just tell our players, let's go paint. Everyone else is in the paint when this player has the ball, because literally we're challenging them to be able to kick out the ball. Now, we can always modify that and say, we're paint, except on number 10. Number 10, we're out on, because they're the one shooter. So we can constantly modify. And this is our conceptual approach to defenses. I don't necessarily teach a defensive system. I just teach defensive concepts. And sometimes that's lost. We always think about conceptual offense. But conceptual defense is somewhat easy to teach because those principles plays are opposites. If you think about shot selection, offense wants to score in the smile, what we'd call a gold medal. And defense, your whole goal is to prevent any shot in the smile. So we're going to always gear our defense towards not letting someone get to the smile. Our second choice is to eliminate any silver medal shots. So we don't want to allow any open shots. That means we want to contest, we want to rotate and contest. And our preference is that every player on our opponent's team shoots bronze medals, meaning they shoot some type of contested shot, or no medals. You could also go to no medals. I've done that with certain players and certain teams to be able to exaggerate it. Incidentally, another huge part of the teaching process is exaggerating. And we would exaggerate it for certain players and just say, hey, listen, you're a no medal shooter. I would love to get you to a bronze medal shooter, but you're a no medal shooter, meaning you take a lot of dribble off the dribble contested shots, and getting them to understand that doesn't help them. And that's the bottom line. Most behavior change has to do with, it just doesn't help you. Why are you doing this behavior? It doesn't help you. And inherently bring it back to them in a selfish way and saying, you want to be a good player, then why are you doing something that doesn't help you? Because I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm just trying to help you understand. I think anyone that's studied some of the shot selection stuff around threes and layups and pull-ups certainly understands that a lot of coaches teach it in that context. We're just trying to help you be more effective and more efficient. So we certainly bring that up for players and educate them about that. So they have those principles of play. I taught defense. So they understand defense. We only talk really essentially shrink the floor and then understanding positioning relative to the ball, which we all know. But we talk about it in terms of this. We talk about any player on the floor needs to know who's your check and what's your responsibility. So if the ball is on top in the five out, the player covering the ball knows their check and they know their responsibility because it's relative to forcing the ball where there is less space. So we want to force the ball into less space. So let's say there's a high post and the ball's on the wing. Even if our philosophy was to force baseline, we would always change our philosophy anytime there's a high post and force the ball towards the high post. Why? Because there's less space. We want to force the ball to less space. So we'll constantly communicate to players about that, about defensively, just understanding that. Now, there's some more nuances to that, which is weak hand, strong hand. Certainly telling players, for example, my one daughter's left-handed. So I'll go to certain players and say, who are covering her constantly throughout, say the 5-on-5, and just say, look, you know she's left-handed. Don't let her go left. That's great. It's great for the defenders to start to conceptualize that. It's also really good for my daughters to start to figure out different things. And she's certainly adapted over time because I've done that enough. But that's really the way to be able to shape offense, is to be able to constrain the defense. And to go to the defense and say, hey, listen, we're forcing everything left hand. Then you're constraining the defense to be able to help them shape the offense. And that's a big part of kind of these things. So for me, getting them to understand the defense, and then we played 5-on-5, outlet to coach again, 5-on-5. And then we stopped it after, let's say, 10 possessions again. I don't know, remember the exact number. And then we taught dribble at as a structure. Okay, here's dribble at. And then we created the constraint where they must run the dribble at. So every time they outlet the ball to the coach, we must run a dribble at. Immediately, this is a huge problem in youth basketball development. We know already on a team, there's one person that's a point guard, and then the other players do this and this. I will not run any type of youth practice or youth development situation where every single time we don't rotate who plays point and who plays different positions. If we're really talking about developing a holistic basketball player, then we want them to do that. Because I've seen it, particularly with my youngest daughter, where she got stuck being someone who runs to corners in a 4-out offense. Great offense. Everything was good in terms of that. But she got stuck, especially in her first few months, where she didn't necessarily advocate for herself. And I certainly wasn't going to step in yet and do anything. But where she got stuck just going to the same spots all the time. That's not development. That's learning a system. If we're talking about development, we want them to be able to play in every spot, in every way. And who's to say that my tall young daughter isn't going to be a point guard when she's old? We don't know. So we really try and conceptualize for all players that you are a basketball player, not a position, and that we want every single one of you to think of yourselves as someone who can shoot, pass, and handle. Now, there are limitations on that, clearly, because some players haven't worked on their game, haven't player-led themselves. That's a different story. We can get into that a different day, but we certainly want to challenge them to be able to develop their game so they can do multiple things. But within the scope of these 5-on-5 practices, we have a different player handle the ball all their time. We're not team specific. We're player development specific within a team concept. And that's probably a good blueprint for a lot of you in your off seasons, is to have players play in multiple spots in different spots. Because again, one player tends to dominate the ball. Other players don't get a chance to be able to problem solve. And regardless of whether you go back to this template where you're the point guard and you're the ball screener and you're the shooter, that's all good for the season when you're trying to win games. But in the off season, give them a chance to be able to be problem solvers and try and figure some things out. And that's always advantageous in that way. So we went whole, 5-on-5 the whole time. We didn't change anything relative to that. The only thing we changed is the constraints. So we went from free play, where all they had to do is fill the spacing spots. We went into basically them having to now run dribble at. And then within that, the only thing that we coached as a turnover or a foul was when they didn't run a dribble at. So if they didn't run a dribble at, they lost possession of the ball. Now, the beautiful thing about principles of play is it really frees you up as a coach, that I'm not coaching 100 different things within the 5-on-5. I'm generally coaching the situations like, did you have space? Where can you find space? Did you take away space on defense? And I use questions a lot in my coaching because I want to engage players and I want them to be mindful and not mindless. So I spend a lot of time in getting them to be able to engage with the material, interact with the material, both physically and mentally by asking questions and obviously having them be a lot of game-based play. So our principles of play are the things that I focus on coaching enough. So after they played for a little bit, literally we could play 5-on-5 and all I would need to call out each time was whether it was a bronze medal, silver medal, or gold medal. And generally, I really want to call out, especially regardless of whether the shot went in, I want to call out silver medal and I want to call out gold medal. Those are the things that we want replicated. So we want to make sure that we positively reinforce the things we want to have happen again and again. And sometimes that might mean I stop it and I say, hey, really outstanding example of running dribble at to create space, drove the ball, we drew two, we passed it, and we created a silver medal shot. I want to acknowledge those things. I want to notice those things. So we normalize those things. And you've heard me talk about that hopefully before. I just posted a video on Twitter about that. But this concept of being able to notice things. So I notice something. There's a behavior that we want to have happen. So I'm going to make sure that I notice it so the players replicate it. And then I want to normalize it as saying, hey, this is normal. This is what we're not going to do. You might be thinking about intensity and effort and on-task behaviors and some things like that. I just want to qualify that. I immediately, anytime that I start sessions with a player, I will actively find a time early on, maybe in the first 15, 20 minutes, where I will hold, come here, 4-3-2-1. I always bring players in when I want to give them really specific information about something around behavior or something around effort, because I don't want to shout throughout the gym. I want to bring them in and make it intimate. And then I'll say something like, I'm not here to coach effort. And I just call them out on that part right away. I'm not here to coach behavior and I'm not here to coach effort. My value to you is that I can help you get better at basketball. I'm not your motivator. That's not my job. Your parents not your motivator. A coach is not your motivator. A teacher's not a motivator. If you want to get better at basketball, that's your responsibility. And really putting a lot of individual responsibility on players to be able to manage that. And I would say that throughout a 3-day camp where I've had 80 kids for 3 days, by and large, with me alone in the gym, I would say by and large, I have no behavioral problems, because immediately we will bring attention to that in that way and say, why are you here? You're here to get better at basketball. And by and large, the other reason is because we're playing basketball. Players are not off task generally when they're playing basketball. They're off task when they're doing things that aren't representative of the game, I feel, more often than not, because as I said, it comes back to engagement and just a little bit of lack of focus because they're not engaged. It's not interesting. It's really hard to stay engaged if you're not playing basketball. So this dribble at and the spacing template, those things connect. The defense, the principles of play on offense and defense, those things connect. And we're really quickly helping them understand these concepts. So defensively, who's your check? What's your responsibility? On the ball, pretty simple. Coming back to it, if you're off the ball, think about this. Let's say I am on the right side of the ball. So my responsibility is if the ball goes right. That's my help responsibility. My check is my player on the wing. Let's say in the 5-out, there's a player behind that player defensively. Then we talk to them and we say, who's your check? My closeout's a corner. What's your responsibility? And sometimes they struggle with that at first, but it really makes sense. Their responsibility is the ball. Their responsibility is the ball relative to their teammate. We always highlight to players that the ball scores. The ball scores. Your check without the ball does not score. Now, that can lead to a score and that can lead to a big advantage. But we initially want players to understand that if you're two passes away, then your responsibility is to support your teammate in stopping the ball. So if they rotate to stop the ball, you have to rotate probably to be able to support them in some way, whether that's a bluff or a full rotate and an X out or a help and recover, whatever your philosophy is defensively, it's all good. We wouldn't define that for them early. We want them to figure it out and we'll go from there. But those things are all a part of kind of conceptually how we develop the defensive concepts, shrink the floor, and then who's your check and what's your responsibility? And then are you defending? Is a mouse attacking you or is a turtle attacking you? And those things would help them communicate to their teammates about whether they need help or they don't need help. And game of opposite. So if I am someone who's very good defensively and I'm covering someone who cannot attack, then what can we do? We can immediately be able to call out, I don't need help. No help. No help means that nobody helps. I can stop the ball one-on-one. And why is that a good advantage on defense? Because it allows us to take away space. that there's no pass, there's no space, and the player can't beat us. So it's much harder for the offense to be able to create an advantage, to be able to create an advantage because they can't take advantage of the space because the player can't beat someone off the dribble. Another part I just want to highlight, one of the biggest challenges in this session was this concept of players picking up the ball without a decision. This leads into what's called protection plans. What's a protection plan? A protection plan is how do we get out of trouble when we're in trouble? A lot of you play one-on-one where you'll play one-on-one with a constraint saying it's a two dribble limit. Okay, again, not in judgment, but the problem with that is it generally teaches players that if they can't create some type of good shot in two dribbles, they're taking a bronze medal shot or a no medal shot, or they're picking up the ball without a decision. So we don't try and limit dribbles. We try and limit directions. We can talk more about that in some other day. But essentially what that connects for in these 5-on-5 situations is how many players caught the ball and then dribbled and picked up the ball, not knowing what they're going to do yet. And that's where we try and define advantage. If you have a shoulder chest advantage, you have space, keep going. If you dribble and the defender's still chest to chest, then you counter or you can initiate some type of action, whether it's a dribble add or a dribble handoff or something. Or if you run out of space, you can use a backup dribble, retreat dribble, whatever you call it. Or you drive and you get some type of penetration inside the three-point line and you have space, you can turn a drive into a Barkley, which means turns a drive into a post-up. Or if you're driving and you don't have a decision, but you have space to keep your dribble alive, then you can keep your dribble alive and you can actually cross sides of the floor. We call that a Nash. So these protection plans are really important for players to be able to understand how to keep the dribble alive and how to keep the flow of the possession going rather than picking up the ball and going dead and now us having to scramble to be able to get out of those situations. Incidentally, we do teach them how to get out of dead. And that's the first thing I taught to my really unskilled group from the last year was what happens on dead. Someone cuts, someone fills. When someone cuts, it creates space, and now someone can fill space. That's the easiest way to be able to get out of trouble and dead. What we don't want to do, which they naturally tend to do, maybe from they all played mini soccer where everyone just runs to the ball, but it tends to be with unskilled players, they all run to the ball on dead because they think that you got to go get the ball from them. But that tends to bring, obviously, less space to the ball and less of a possible advantage and less of a solution. So we talk about things like that. So asking questions, I just want to go through a few other things real quickly here. You'll notice I ask questions early on in learning. I don't hold as much space for them in terms of their answers. Usually it's just a pause so that they engage with the question for a little bit. But often I have to use some type of explicit instruction. I talk about three E's in the way that I approach coaching. First E is environment. I'm trying to create an environment. I've explained that a lot. Exploration is the second E, where I want to give them opportunities to explore without me telling them exactly what to do. Usually that's the initial part, is that we create the environment like we did with the 5-on-5-on-5 LO to coach. They get a chance to explore. And then I can use explicit instruction where they give them instruction. So in the example I talked about just then, that I do give them more explicit instruction early on in learning so they get a little bit of structure to what they're going to do. So with a question, I might not pause as long and allow them to interact with it as long. But later on in learning, then almost all of my questions become a lot more open-ended in terms of pause and say, what was your solution? What was your thought process? And again, did they make a decision that was wrong, or did they just do something different than what you think they should have done? And I think that's something to constantly reflect on as a coach is, did I correct someone because they're wrong? Or did I correct someone because they just did something different than what I would have done? And that's a big thing to think about as you listen to your feedback. Now, obviously, I've encouraged many of you to be able to record your practices and just listen to your feedback. So the other part that goes with asking questions that I feel leads to deeper learning is this concept of mini conversations. And there's many examples on this 5-on-5 video that I'll share a little bit more in full at some point beyond just the clip that I gave you. But I have a lot of mini conversations. So now the players know what they're doing. The big picture is I coach the principles of play and the constraint. The little picture is now I go to players and give them a lot more individual attention. I apply the law of biological individuality. I'm not going to coach the whole group on something that I can coach one player on. Now, if say more than five people are struggling with the same concept, then probably all of them are struggling with the same concept. So I can hold, recreate, talk about the concept, and then follow feedback with action and go from there. But if it's one player struggling with certain things, then I want to have a lot of mini conversations to be able to help shape them learning. Really specific, really brief, really positive. Hey, great effort, finding space on your cut. Now, where can you get into space and get out of space faster? So we're giving them an example of saying, okay, they did something well, and now what can they do better? That type of value content specific feedback. It's much better than saying good job. And I say good still, because those are hustle prompts, but I know it's useless information, especially when I listen to it later. So I have to laugh at myself. I say it too much, but they're hustle prompts. Let's go. Good. Let's go. Good. It's just hustle prompts. It really doesn't give them any information. It's not reinforcing anything. It's not improving anything, but it helps create this environment that we want, a little bit of communication and movement and hustle. But for me, it's more about the value that I can add with my feedback. And I find that I can add a lot more value to a player with a mini conversation where I'm just talking to them individually because they know I'm talking to them. The problem with general feedback is, in general feedback, it tends to be just me talking and players not knowing who I'm talking about, unless I do literally single them out and I say, hey, Chris, you need to do better in this situation by doing this. They know I'm talking about Chris. But otherwise, if I just talk about general, hey, we need to do better in this situation and this, then they're less likely to think I'm talking about them. So I'll always qualify any type of group conversation with saying, hey, listen, this and this, or these teams, or this team, or these people are struggling with this. So I'm sure it's happening to all of you. And remember, I've created psychological safety. So players are generally okay with me coaching them because if we connected it to their improvement and our team's improvement, we constantly connected back to that they should be and need to be welcoming of feedback because the goal is for all of us to improve. Okay, we've talked about a lot of things. I want you to go to basketballimmersion.com/5on5podcast, watch the video. You've already listened to the audio and check out a little bit more in depth what I'm talking about. I'll include some information there on some of the things we talked about at the podcast. But all I wanted to do here is add some value for those that can't travel and see me coach. Whether you agree with the way I coach or you don't, that's all good. It's always a psychologically safe environment when you come watch me or you interact with me. You're okay. You're safe to disagree with me. You're safe to agree with me. You're okay to agree, build on, or challenge what I'm saying. All of that is good. All of that is good. But a lot of you can't get to see me coach. And I really do think there's some value to the way that I do it for you to be able to take pieces of it, parts of it, holes of it, and to be able to adapt it or adopt it to your coaching. So I wanted to give you a real good framework of what I mean by saying I taught a whole year of college basketball with just doing 5-on-5 outside of, again, they did some shooting drills, two balls, three shooters within practice, as kind of mental breaks. But otherwise we play 5-on-5 every single situation. I'm doing it with young players. This isn't an age thing. Decisions are absolutely age appropriate at all ages of basketball. So don't get hung up on all this. You can't do this with younger players. You can't do this with unskilled players. In fact, I think it's more important to do it with younger and unskilled players because now we build a conceptual framework to be able to understand why you're doing some of these other things with them. Why are you doing some of these dribble moves? Why are you doing some of these pass and cut moves? Why are you doing some of these defensive slides or these defensive closeout drills? Why are you doing them? Because we've taught out a 5-on-5, we're giving them a better conceptual framework to understand what we're going to do next. And that's what you would see if you saw me run a camp, you saw me run multiple player development sessions, which I've done throughout the world. You would see me do that, where it's this whole picture. And now we'll do the parts, as I said, game-based, and we'll connect them to the big picture constantly. And it's this constant thing of what I call reconnections. And that's really the value of what I feel I can do as a coach, is that I can constantly connect and reconnect things, because my goal is obviously to be able to heighten teaching that leads to learning so that players can have a better experience transferring things from practice to the games. Thank you for letting me share that with you. We rely on coaches like you to keep these valuable conversations going. So I'd like to ask you to consider supporting our basketball immersion community and your coaching. If you have never been a member or if you're a former member, please consider supporting our Sharing the Game with a membership. From NBA head coaches to parents leading youth teams, our community is diverse, dynamic, and dedicated to excellence. With full access to courses, videos, and insider strategies on how we teach the game, plus team systems like the two-side fast break, the 32 matchup zone, and the 10 switching defense, you'll be equipped with the tools you need to succeed. Whether you're a solo coach seeking individual growth or part of a coaching staff looking to revolutionize your approach, Basketball Immersion has something for everyone. Visit basketballimmersion.com/sales today to explore membership options and take your coaching to new heights. Plus, your membership directly supports this podcast. And the best part, there's flexible pricing options with membership levels that fit everyone's needs and budgets. Join our vibrant community of coaches for as low as $33 a month and gain instant access to our entire library of resources. That's hundreds of videos, in-depth courses, and proven drills, all designed to empower you to help your players improve and win more games. I hope you enjoyed this deep dive into my coaching philosophies and practice strategies. Ready to take your coaching to the next level? Head over to basketball.com/sales and explore our membership options and support our podcast and all of our social media sharing. Thanks for listening and keep on coaching.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show and to give the Basketball Podcast and this week's guest a shout out on social media to show your support for us sharing the game. And to stay up to date on all things Basketball Immersion, subscribe to our newsletter at basketballimmersion.com/newsletter.